Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein with another conversation. Today we have Professor Lawrence Mead. He's professor of politics and public policy at NYU. He's been a longtime influential figure in the crafting of welfare policy. He was an important figure in the 90s when that was going on. His books include Beyond Entitlement, The Social Obligations of Citizenship. That goes back to the 1980s. An early 90s book, The New Politics of Poverty, The Non-Working Poor in America. And now, which is the subject for us today, a book that's just out with Encounter Books entitled Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference and American Power. Welcome. Thank you for joining us, Professor Mead.
Well, I'm very glad to be here. Thanks very much.
Okay. Well, you know, the first question, when I was reading the opening sections of the book, you refer to something called the, quote, individualistic style of Americans. And this is sort of my way of getting into your subtitle there. What is the individualistic style of Americans that you consider really an essential trait?
Yeah. Well, individualism is a culture in which people seek primarily to achieve their own goals and values. And the way I characterize that is their lives proceed from the inside out. They have certain goals and they seek to realize them in the world. So the movement is from what I seek to do to some change in the outside world. And that, it turns out, is very distinctive to the Western world and especially to America. America is probably the most strongly individualist country in the world. It produces a dynamic society in which many people are trying to improve things. So there's constant change, even turmoil, as we, for example, see right now. But the overall result is to move the society towards improvements of all kinds, both economic, political, and otherwise. And that style is actually quite unusual in the world as a whole.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that struck me in there is you're not highlighting first, at least, individual rights. You talk about this as a style, which gets us to the whole subtitle there of your book, Cultural Difference.
Yes. In fact, I don't really think of individualism as primarily about rights. In fact, I really define it as a form of obligation. The individualist way of life makes you responsible for many things. You have to satisfy government's requirements. You also face competition with other people who want the same things that you want. Individualist society is much more competitive than any other. And you also have to decide the goals that you want. And those are the ones that are really the most pressing. That's the thing that you organize your life around. And so freedom isn't free. Freedom involves heavy responsibilities. Now, rights also follow from the sense people have that they are powerful and effective in the world. It's precisely the fact that they possess obligations that gives them claims to rights against government and against other people. But we can't have rights without obligations. We have to have an internal commitment to certain principles that allow us to live an orderly life and achieve our own goals. It's that commitment that actually generates the force of individual rights.
Is that outlook, the burdens side, is that correspondent with, you know, the John Stuart Mill, you know, the Liberty Principle? You know, individualism I can do anything I want as long as I'm not preventing anyone else from doing what he wants.
Yes, that's right. It is consistent with Mill, but Mill, like most political thinkers, operated in a totally individualist climate where he never considered the issues raised by cultural difference. He never addressed the issues we face today, where much of the population and the entire non-Western world is not individualist, where people have much more passive, more reactive sense of what life's about. Yeah. Mill really never considered that. He considered passivity is not part of Mill's conception, but it is fundamental to the non-Western world.
What you just said a moment ago, you used the word exceptional. And that Mill just breathed an air of individualism. That was just the world that he lived in. And that there is a great mistake in people in the... Well, how wide is the world? Is the Anglo-American world and much of Western Europe, maybe part of Eastern Europe, that simply, again, lives in an individualistic style and doesn't really think about it, just takes it as the normal state of affairs.
That's right.
But this is
That's
actually a very parochial sense.
We take that as normal, even universal, but it's not. Much of our problems arise from the fact that we don't credit that much of the world is different. Europe, Western Europe, particularly Eastern Europe, mostly is also individualist in the sense that people live out in this, that they have this conception of inner driven. Life is inner driven. You proceed from the inside out. You have things in your head you're trying to realize out in the world. That isn't the way most people live in the world. Most people are far more passive, reactive. Their goal is to satisfy the demands made on them by the outside world. They themselves don't really seek change. They're trying to find out what the world requires of them and adjust to that. And they're also much less individualist. They don't think of themselves as individuals seeking a distinctive goal. Rather, they're members of groups, and they go with the flow. They go with what other people expect of them.
And they don't experience that as any form of oppression or...
Yeah. In fact, it's the opposite. It's precisely because they accept the need to adjust to outward requirements that they actually are less burdened than people in the West, because that's all they have to do is satisfy the outside authorities. After that, they're uncommitted. They can do whatever they want. They really are less committed than Westerners who have characteristic goals they're trying to achieve. So, I mean, one of the things that made me realize that freedom isn't free is that the people that I know, and most of us know, who have careerist kind of jobs, we realize that we're actually burdened by our expectations for ourselves. We're not free. The rhetoric says we have opportunity, and that's true, but opportunity comes at the price of commitments that make us committed to do certain things in the future. So our current lives are bound by the things we're trying to do in the future. I mean, the phrase I hit on a long time ago is that those who would be free must first be bound. The boundedness is the thing that actually makes them free. And whereas in the non-West, the lack of the boundedness, the inner boundedness, is essential to the fact that they live unfree lives, because for them, the obligations remain external, things that other people expect them to do. But they themselves are not bound by their own goals. Their own goals, in fact, are largely to satisfy the other people. So their commitments are actually far fewer than people typically have in the West.
Does this mean that people in the non-Western societies are going to experience a political reality such as voting quite differently than the way we will?
Yes, I think they are going to go with the flow. They're going to go with what other people expect them to do. See, the whole idea of voting implies that people can take independent decisions about political issues and then act accordingly. They're autonomous, responsible people who then hold government accountable. That's the Western concept. But it assumes an individualist culture. Whereas in the non-West, people are primarily concerned to satisfy the expectations of others. So they will vote, but the voting will reflect what their group, their party, their class, their village expects. They're not making independent judgments. Now, in all non-Western countries, you do have an elite that is more individualist and has often been educated in the West. So the way they talk and what the press says will make it sound as if these countries are individualist like the West. But that's a thin veneer at the very top of the society, and the rest of the society isn't living a free life and doesn't really want to live a free life, because to be free means taking on board the burdens of freedom, which are heavy.
Do you want to apply this to some of those, I guess, former faiths in the idea of exporting democracy, American-style democracy, to other parts of the world that aren't culturally in sync?
Yeah, I think that that's questionable. And at the end of the book, I have a chapter on policy implications. And certainly one of them is to be very cautious about exporting democracy. Democracy assumes that people do have an autonomous relationship to government and form their own opinions and so on. But equally important, and this is, I have a whole chapter on this in the book, political order in the world requires that there be a civic culture where people feel inwardly responsible for doing the right things, such as obeying the law and paying taxes, being good citizens. And in the West, we have those attitudes as well as a tendency to keep government accountable. So although we are hard on people in authority and we are critical of them, at the same time, America has strong government. Indeed, the strongest government the world has ever seen is in the United States. So that's the paradox, that the individualist temperament, because of its moralism, because it's based on these inner principles, is able to create and sustain a civic culture, which means that corruption is not a fundamental problem. But in the rest of the world, in the non-West, it is a fundamental problem because the moral structure is not based on inner principles. It's based upon conformity to the expectations of others. And that often means corruption, because if you're involved in a group and the group is involved in some way exploiting government, well, you go with the flow. That's what seems to be required. You don't take moralistic objection to it. But unless you do, you can't really sustain good government. So this is why good government really isn't found outside the West. There are a few exceptions to that, but they're quite exceptional. They're really not normal. And that is, I think, why we have to be hesitant about imagining that democracy is going to be possible in many of these countries.
Does this get us to one of the charges you make in the book, that policymakers and even researchers, academic researchers, tend to ignore these cultural differences that they share?
Yeah.
Mills' normalizing assumption. Why?
Yeah, they do.
Why do they not see this? Because when you're talking, this sounds to me self-evident.
It is self-evident, but there's strong resistance to thinking in the terms I'm suggesting, because it implies that individuals can be responsible for something, that they can be held accountable for satisfying the moral values that they have internalized and which are normal in the society. But we have many groups in the society that are not actually Western in origin. They become Westernized over time, but when they first come to America, and this also includes minorities who have been here since the beginning of the country, their views are not individualist. They don't think of life in these terms. So for them, it's really hard to imagine pursuing opportunity in the way that we take as normal. That's only normal in the West. In the non-West, the mode of life that most people think of is simple survival. They're just trying to get through the day. Mm-hmm. Their goals are to get through the immediate situation that they face, and they don't typically organize themselves in the present in order to achieve a future goal. That's very much the Western way. And so for fear of that, experts implicitly assume that the problems that we see amongst low-income society, most of whom have origins outside the West, we assume that that must be due to some barrier or impediment in the background society. We're looking for barriers. And that implies that the society is responsible for the problems rather than the poor themselves. See, that's what we'd like to believe, and that's consistent with Western culture, because the moralism of Western culture says that the society is responsible for the poor and must take steps to help them. That's a very, very important value in the West.
Yeah.
And because we do that, those who are better off, I call it, they hoard their obligations. They are always responsible, and the people they're trying to help are not responsible. They are in some way victimized, oppressed by outside forces. And indeed, they themselves feel this way. There's a truth to that. They do indeed see outside forces as controlling them. But that isn't the way the individualist bulk of the population sees it. Problems that for the poor are prohibitive are not that way for most of this population, because they're simply problems to be overcome in the pursuit of one's goal. And there's much more sense that we can overcome those problems and go ahead. We're not constrained. We face competition and other adversities, but it doesn't mean we're powerless. We're not victims. But in the non-West, the idea that you're confined by outside forces is the normal state of affairs. And people bring that attitude with them when they come to America.
How would you respond to the liberal assumption that, well, everyone in his heart yearns to be free?
I'm doubtful about that. I think the burdens of freedom are heavy. I don't think everyone wants to be free. I think the idea that freedom is a preferable way of life is a Western idea. We who come from that tradition think of it as freedom, but that's only because we're organized to deal with the demands of freedom. And the rest of the world, and conversely, we're not well organized to deal with the demands of necessity. The non-West bears the burdens of necessity and things that they don't control. And when Westerners face that, when there's a great natural disaster, for example, or there's a sudden economic shock and whole millions of people are disadvantaged in some way, The Westerners are not good at that. We're not good at dealing with things that we can't control. I mean, Western culture is really all about mastery. It's all about controlling and exploiting and improving the outside world. And if we can't control something like a big hurricane, we're helpless. We don't deal well with adversity that we don't control. The non-West actually is better at that. And so in my book, I certainly don't regard Western culture as superior. There are certain values where the non-West is stronger. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why we should wish to have a multicultural society. I accept that. I see much to learn from the non-West, and indeed it has already enriched America considerably. That's good. But what I don't want is to have the entry of large numbers of people from the non-West cause America to become a non-Western country overall. That would be a disaster because our achievements and the role we play in the world depends absolutely on the maintenance of an individualist culture.
This gets us to the very delicate issue, right, of immigration from third world or the global South, however you want to call it, the non-Western nations. Yeah. Now, I presume that the individualist ethos, the libertarian or the classical liberal faith is that immigrants will come to this country and they will, you know, steadily give up that collectivist ethos and become more and more individualist in their orientations. And it's a process that takes a little time. There may be some bumps here and there. Overall, it works just fine. What do you say?
In principle, I agree with that. It's true that over time, people who come from the non-West do become more individualist. The leading example of this, which I celebrate, is the black middle class. Blacks come mostly out of slavery and before that from Africa. These are experiences that were highly promoting a really passive, reactive, temperate, non-Western way of life. But over time, about a third of black America, I would estimate, is now living an individualist life, which means that they're doing much better than those who don't, which is still, I would say, the majority of blacks. So indeed, they have adjusted. And immigrants also adjust, but it takes longer than we think. I would say it's several generations. There are several studies that actually estimate this for European groups that came from places like Scandinavia to America. There's enough evidence to say that it took them about three generations to adopt American attitudes. And since these were Europeans, where the cultural difference from mainstream America was a lot less than now with today's immigrants, I think we have to say we're looking at maybe a century, something like that, before immigrants would fully acclimatize to an individualist culture. And that assumes that they're under pressure to assimilate. And at the current numbers, many immigrants are going into immigrant communities where they go on living pretty much as they did in the old country. And that means that immigration doesn't really produce assimilation. Indeed, there are pressures not to assimilate. And when they do that, then it seems to me immigrants are really free riding on the rest of the culture. They're basically taking advantage of the many virtues that come with an individualist culture: the rule of law, steady economic growth, strong government, rights, and all those things, all the political and economic values achieved by the West. Those things are achieved mostly in an individualist culture. And those who come and do not adjust are taking advantage of all that, but they're not bearing their share of the burdens of freedom. And they should. They should assimilate. And we should take, and I suggest, a number of steps we can take to promote that. But above all, we have to cut the number of immigrants. I'm not against immigration per se. On the contrary, it's a good thing in principle. But the numbers have to be cut in half, it seems to me, in order to allow there to be more, better assimilation.
That's a calculation that you've made, cutting it in half.
Yeah, yeah.
And
that's right.
So,
and actually, the recommendations I make about that are similar to other critics of immigration. My policy position isn't unusual among people who want to cut back on immigration. What is unusual is that I'm making the argument in terms of cultural difference, mm-hmm. whereas other people talk about more practical problems, like the fact that immigrants come here and they fall into crime, or they go on welfare, mm-hmm. or they might be terrorists, and so on. I think all of that is secondary. The really important reason why immigration is controversial is because people sense that it's changing the nature of the society, and that is true. It is.
We are shifting
towards a less individualist culture, and people are concerned about that, and they should be.
And the problems that you cited a minute ago, those are getting worse.
I'm not sure that crime's getting worse. However, it is more prevalent among Hispanics and blacks than it is among other groups.
Yeah.
Now, advocates will point out that when immigrants first come here, their crime rate is below that of the mainstream population, but that's true for the initial immigrants. And what we find is their children do not usually do as well as the immigrants themselves. They don't have trouble getting through school. They're more likely to fall into crime. There's a Hispanic underclass that's formed alongside the black underclass. So we see this group, as is true also for blacks, divided between a group that's growing into the middle class and another group that's going downhill and not doing well. And that's because for them, the burdens of freedom are too much. They don't function well in society that makes the kind of demands we do on individual people. And you see that especially the problems that Hispanics have getting through school. School is very threatening to them because it's highly competitive. Schools exemplify an individualist ethos where we provide what we hope is equal opportunity, but we also expect people to compete. And competition is not something that one really knows much of in the old country because they didn't have opportunities we have it. Yeah. But our opportunities are not given to people. We expect people to compete to get ahead. And if we don't see that, we're frustrated. We expect that. We want that. We want them to show the energy that's associated with an individualist culture. And they have a hard time with that.
You know, you look at the selective schools where you are at NYU, where I've been at Emory, and
yeah.
I think that many people our age underestimate just how ferociously competitive those
yeah.
environments are, because they weren't as competitive when I was in school. It wasn't so hard to get into medical
yeah.
school in 1983 when I graduated from college.
Yeah.
But now I think you know there are more kids who want to go to med school than there are spaces.
Yeah.
There are more kids who want to go to business school, undergraduate
yeah.
or graduate, than there are spaces. And what you say, yeah, it is a ruthless individualist ethos
yeah.
that one has
yeah.
to adopt right off the
yeah.
bat, no matter how much they push things like collaborative learning and all those ideas. No, you're on your own.
Well, you're not necessarily. See, I don't want to overstress this, because alongside the competition, there is also broad respect for people who do their best, even if they don't win the race. Americans are concerned that everyone make an effort. It's A for effort.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you win the race is really quite secondary to the moral estimation. We care that people show the energy to push ahead and do their best. That's very highly valued. And everyone who does their best is morally equivalent to everybody else, even if those other people did better in competitive terms.
You know, that statement right there, I wish that could be passed around to all parents who want
yeah.
their kids to be achievers.
That's
if you're,
right.
If you're trying as hard, there is no moral difference between an A
That's right.
and a C+.
That's right.
You are morally the same.
My students at NYU, as you point out, are highly selected. These are students who've won a substantial competition to get into the school. And they are mostly, they accept competition. They know it's something they have to face. But those who have come from families who have been in this country longer, I have a lot of students who are immigrants or the children of immigrants. For them, it's harder. They're still adjusting to this. And they often have a hard time doing it. And so America's not, this is not a place for the faint of heart.
Yeah.
You know, it's a place where people do their best. And we're not good. We're not very understanding of people who don't want to do that, don't want to struggle and strive and compete. Not that you have to be in the race in a completely all-out 100-hour-a-day kind of person. You don't have to be that hardworking, but you do have to be employed. You do have to be making an effort. You have to have a goal that's beyond where you are now. That's the key. It's not even working that's so central, though that's the way it's symbolized. It's rather the idea that I have a purpose, that I'm not just existing. I'm not just surviving.
Mm-hmm.
See, and yet that, however, is the way of the non-West. So people who come here from these other cultures have to gear up and limit a different way. And this is really hard. And we don't really understand that because the immigrants we had 100 years ago, the last time we had a really big immigrant wave, they mostly came from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, they hit the ground running mostly. And they didn't face the same problems that we have today. So we tend to think that immigration is easily absorbed, but we haven't really adjusted to the fact that today's immigrants are really quite different from in the past because they're not coming from the Western world. And therefore, their adjustment is much, much greater.
You know, on that, I want to get to a couple quotes in the book.
Yeah.
But on that point, what you just said, Larry, how many politicians are going to take up that idea and try to develop policy out of that? Because in a lot of areas, that's an untouchable point.
I know. You see, the politicians is always easier to maintain the tendency of the mainstream population to hoard its obligations and to make no expectations of others. They have rights. I mean, this is one of the things that got me into welfare as a subject when I first got into it. What struck me about poverty was that the poor and welfare recipients had nothing but rights and claims. I don't mean they were all satisfied, but what one couldn't do is expect anything of them. They had no obligations. The obligations were hoarded by the better off. They saw it as their obligation to help the poor, which is true. We do have an obligation. But what's missing is the idea that the poor should help themselves. Now, in welfare reform, we managed at least to institute that for part of the welfare population. We said, yes, you have to work if you're on aid. And most of them complied. Mm-hmm. But the thing that the left has never accepted is that there should be an obligation. See, it's okay to offer people the choice of working, the choice of opportunity. But what that doesn't, however, yield a result, because that assumes that the people you're trying to help are individualists, that they're capable of binding themselves to a future goal. Mm-hmm. But they're not, because they're coming from the non-West. So for them, the point is to satisfy, to live in the present, rather than to look down the road and do what that requires. So opportunities, incentives, benefits do not produce a change in lifestyle. It's been really hard for academics and especially economists to accept that because they assume a universal personality where everybody's trying to optimize their utilities. And they're puzzled when poor people do not respond to incentives. Mm-hmm. Well, that's because they're not on the make. They're not trying to get somewhere and do something. They're trying to survive right now in the present, today. And that's the difference. And it's really hard for people to say. So that I, among my various arguments in social policy, one of them is in favor of what's called paternalism. Paternalism is an approach where we help the poor, but we tell them what they should do. It's not about opportunity now. It's about obligations. We say you have to work, have to get through school, have to obey the law, and so on. And that those programs show better implementation and impact results than programs that merely offer opportunities.
Yeah,
and the reason is they're providing the external authority structure that the non-Western groups need in order to function. That's what their culture assumes, is an external authority structure.
I know people who hate that idea of actually
putting
an obligation and laying down directives to people. Let me quote one thing, this slight change of subject. You have a quote here. The truth is that freedom by itself never generated wealth or power. Certainly undercuts a very strong assumption at large today.
Well, we think freedom is free. There's a rhetoric, particularly on the right, that says that the free economy is a kind of magician that just generates wealth and power and you don't have to do a whole lot to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's just not true. Capitalism is an extremely demanding system. And it has to be, otherwise it wouldn't generate the wealth that it does. And it's hard for other societies to accept the need. Now, other societies can, in fact, be disciplined because they do have a more collective idea of obligation than an individualist country. So you'll see cases like Japan and China and other Asian countries where they've been able to use a collective culture, in fact, to get people to work hard and generate more wealth and power. There's another way to get rich and power. You don't necessarily have to be an individualist country, but you have to generate effort. And the Asians do it one way, and the Western world does it another way. And America is a demanding country. That's why the marketplace is tough on people. It demands effort, demands hard work, and that's why we get something out of it. We get the products that we have. We get the ability to lead the world, in fact. So the The fruit of freedom is very, very important. That is what America is really set up to do. And indeed, the whole Western culture is oriented, above all, to the mastery of the outside world, to the generation of wealth and power. That isn't all that's important, but that's what we have excelled at, and that's why we're leading the world. And we don't want to lose that, because that's the rest of the world is assuming that we can do that, that we are, in fact, going to go on leading the world. And the Asians, although they've become richer, have not, I don't think, yet shown a capacity to really rival the West because their culture is not so innovative. Mm-hmm. See, in the West, the burdens of innovation are broadly distributed over the entire population. That's the burdens of freedom. People are trying to fix and improve things all the time. Whereas in Asia, the problem solving, it tends to be at the top of the society. It's the leaders who decide what to do, and everybody else is following orders. So the innovation isn't as deeply rooted as it is in the United States. When the United States is really mobilized around a great goal, let's say flying to the moon back in the 60s, you see extraordinary creativity at all levels. Mm-hmm. And people don't wait for orders. They just go ahead and do it. They solve problems and they improve things. And it's like, whereas the Asians have a few people for solving problems, the United States has an entire society solving problems. And that is really no other culture can compete with.
Last question. You bring up a couple of times Francis Fukuyama and the thesis of the end of history. How does, maybe you could tell people just quickly the end of history thesis and how it figures in your take.
Yeah. Fukuyama is a very important writer. He's the nearest equivalent to the role that I'm playing in this book, which is to offer an overall interpretation of the trend of history. In his best-known book, called The End of History, he argued that essentially ideological divisions within the world had been settled, that it was more or less accepted after the collapse of communism that socialism and collective economies were not as efficient as capitalism, and also that democracy was the most legitimate political order. So these institutions, which are central to the Western world, had been accepted as the norm really around the world, everywhere. And indeed, it's true that a lot of countries have gone over to some versions of democracy and capitalism in the last 20 years. So it looks like he's right. But the deep divisions, but the fading of those divisions occurred really only within the Western cultures, because it was in the West that those were issues. And it was only within individuals' culture that one could talk about those alternatives. So today, those divisions have indeed become more quiescent, but the really important divisions are now between the Western culture as a whole, individualism as a whole, and the non-Western world. So the real divisions now are cultural. They're not ideological any longer. Mm-hmm. And unlike the ideological cultures, they really can't be compromised. When you're looking at the division between ourselves and Islam or ourselves and China, you're talking about a fundamental difference of worldview. And above all, those are cultures that are not individualist, where people take orders, where they follow where they're told what to do, and they defer to authority. See, these are not Western attitudes. The West, although it's highly civic and is able to support strong government, is also critical of power, critical of authority. That is unique to the West. And it is possible only because people internalize these moral principles about a civic order. That's why they're able to do that, why they can stand up against government. I mean, the sort of reaction that Trump's getting is a display of that kind of moralism. The political class rises up against a leader whom they see as abusive in various ways, and Trump himself is a moralist. Trump has his own criticisms of what other people have done. So the characteristic battles in Western politics are within a moralistic culture. But we have problems dealing with a non-moralistic culture, a culture that isn't inner-driven, where people are passive and reactive, where they don't respond to opportunity, where they don't take on the burdens of freedom. And then that becomes a basis for criticizing mainstream society. We have activists who appear and say, oh, gee, poor people are falling behind, or minorities are falling behind, and that's due to the society. And of course, the mainstream culture accepts that judgment because we are responsible for those groups. But what we can't do is... But there's no solution because the passive groups that we're talking about remain passive. They don't. Anything we do to them does not cause them to change their view of the world and adopt responsibility for themselves, because then they would be individualists. They would have to take on the burdens of freedom, and that's hard. So the non-Western groups remain passive and they become objects of criticism by advocates who are not themselves passive, who are thoroughly individualist themselves, but they're speaking on behalf of people who are not individualists, who are passive. And the problem fundamentally is the passivity. I'm not saying they should accept their lot. On the contrary, they should march on Washington. They should march on whatever they're objecting to, but they should take responsibility. See, that's what happened in the Civil Rights Movement. The Civil Rights Movement was a civic movement in my sense. The leaders were acting as individualists, and their followers are that way as well. And they took responsibility. Mm-hmm. So that was very different from what we're seeing today, where identity politics essentially uses the passive outgroups to make a judgment against the society, which is much more active than they are. And whereas what the mainstream society really wants is for these other groups to become active, for them to take on the burdens of freedom. They might be more critical if they did. They might be more difficult in some ways. They might be like the labor movement, which was pushy and aggressive, but they were taking responsibility for themselves. We'd rather they were pushy and aggressive than not pushy and aggressive. And so that is why it's so hard to deal with these demands, because they're on behalf of people who fundamentally are not helping themselves, but who are engaging in survival. And we don't know how to deal with that. That's a new experience for American politics. And it's a really distressing problem. And it's, in some ways, the problem we're going to face in the future is how to deal with the ongoing and apparently unlimited demands by passive groups that are outside the mainstream society and who are simply not living in the way that the rest of America assumes. And we have to somehow persuade those groups to become individualists themselves. That's what the black middle class has done. They are my heroes. They have done exactly what the rest of black America and Hispanic America and the Native Americans and the Asians should all be doing. They should be moving towards individualism. And they are over time, but it should be speeded up. We should do whatever we can to move those groups towards taking more responsibility for their own future.
The book is Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference and American Power, out with Encounter Books. Thank you, Professor Mead.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.